From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
New developments in the attempt by Brazil's right-wing opposition to remove Workers' Party President Dilma Rousseff from office in what many call a slow-moving coup. Protesters gathered in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Monday to protest the impeachment process against the president after Senate leader Renan Calheiros denied a motion by the Speaker of the lower house, Waldir Maranhão, to annul the impeachment process and return the case to the lower house. Maranhão later rescinded his move. Protesters gathered outside the Sao Paulo Museum of Art in the center of the city. A heightened police presence was there monitoring them. The motion by the Speaker of the House to annul the vote and return the process to his chamber was rejected by the President of Brazil's Senate, who said the process would go ahead with a key vote starting the impeachment trial set to take place in the Senate Wednesday. There were questions about whether or not that would be moved to Thursday after the events Monday. Maranhão was appointed acting Speaker of the lower house last week after Eduardo Cunha, who began the impeachment process against President Rousseff, was himself removed by the Supreme Court on corruption charges. Meanwhile, many on the ground have decided not to take matters lying down. In the state of Sao Paulo Monday, at least 1,000 families belonging to the country's landless workers movement occupied one of Vice President Michel Temer's farms located in Duartina, protesting his participation in the attempted coup. The workers also denounced the farm's cultivation of eucalyptus, which creates, they say, a green desert due to the environmental damage caused by the crop. Although the 1,500-hectare property called Esmeralda does not officially belong to Temer, local residents consider him the actual owner. Temer comes from the same Brazilian Democratic Movement Party as Eduardo Cunha, who had spearheaded the push for impeachment prior to his dismissal as president of the chamber by the Supreme Court last week for reported attempts to obstruct a corruption investigation against him and intimidating lawmakers. Brazilian law stipulates that if an impeachment trial is convened in the Senate, the president is automatically forced to step down for up to 180 days while the Senate considers the case. That could leave Temer as president of Brazil, even if only on a temporary basis. The vice president is currently negotiating the formation of a coalition government with other opposition parties, primarily with the Brazilian Social Democratic Party. His own party indicated that it would implement sweeping austerity reforms, including cuts to the family food basket program, in a report that was revealed by local media. The report also said that the party would consider cutting a large housing program for the poor and displaced workers, as well as a program to make college education more accessible. We'll have more on this and other news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean when we speak with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, later in this newscast. Meanwhile, another occupation in South America could prove to be a model for U.S. workers facing the closure of domestic plants and the transfer of their jobs offshore. Workers in Venezuela took action when their factory was shut down, saying that when owners decided the factory would stop producing, the workers should take it over and operate it themselves. They were joined in that message by Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro in recent weeks, as his government attempts to revive the country's economy and reduce its dependence on the oil revenues that have been falling in the past 2 years. Telesur's Ian Bruce visited an occupied factory in the center of the country and filed this report.
Valencia, Venezuela's main manufacturing center and home to much of the country's auto industry. But most of the car plants here have ground to a halt. That's not the case here at Sudamericanos Doblados, a small factory that used to make plastic fuel tanks. Yepsi and Jonathan led an occupation when the US-Brazilian owners abandoned it in 2014. And wrecked the main molding machine before they left.
They damaged it by inventing two cables to block the valves. And they sabotaged the software in this control panel by emptying out all of the information for the different kinds of fuel tanks we made. But we've almost repaired everything now.
They're using the machines that do work to recycle plastic, selecting, cleaning, and grinding it for reuse. It's not just about saving their jobs and wages. They want to encourage recycling and even urban agriculture in the community. And combine this with restarting their own production.
I'm very happy because we're giving a great demonstration here at Sudamericana Factory that it can be done. And I'm sure we will be able to restart machines and diversify our work.
They're not making gasoline tanks anymore here at Sudamericana, but they are using the old ones they still have to grow vegetables. And they're giving an example of how workers can run their own factory. Ian Bruce, Telesur, Valencia, Venezuela.
And we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, for a look at the situation in Brazil and elsewhere in the Latin America and Caribbean region. Tony, welcome back.
Hi, Don. Good to talk to you again. I suppose we should start talking straight away since we're pushed for time.
Yeah, let's go to Brazil. I mean, I'm trying to figure out, we're looking at the new speaker of the House, the lower house, saying let's rescind the referral to the Senate. The Senate saying, no, we're going to vote on it, this having to do with the impeachment referral on Dilma Rousseff from the right wing.
Yeah, and perhaps we need to go back a bit. And on Friday, the Senate, the upper house of the Brazilian legislature, followed the example of their lower house counterparts, and they had a commission of about 20 senators that had to decide whether or not to go ahead with the attempt to implement an impeachment process. And so 15-5, I think it was, or wasn't it? Was that it?
That's about right, yeah.
And I think it was something like that. Voted in favor of continuing the process, and that meant that by tomorrow, Wednesday, the Senate would have a full-blown vote about whether to, involving all in a plenary session,
right,
about whether to proceed with the impeachment. And then yesterday we had this extraordinary event when. And then the other important thing that happened, of course, was that Eduardo da Cunha, the corrupt president of the lower house of the Brazilian legislature, was removed from his post.
That's right. He was removed. A new one was put in. The new one said, let's go back and reevaluate this. And the Senate said, basically, no, too late. We have it now. And everybody's trying to figure out what that means legally. But politically,
yeah,
let's explore
but there's
it.
Been,
yeah.
There's been even another twist now.
Because, I can't even keep up. Go ahead. What
because,
else?
Because the guy, Maranhão, the guy who replaced Cunha, who had actually voted against the impeachment process in the lower house vote,
right,
but he being a member of one of the opposition parties, and so it was quite surprising that he took the decision to suspend the impeachment. But then, either late last night or early this morning, he changed his mind again and said, "All right, then, well, let's go ahead with it." And so that's that was after he'd been kind of rebuffed by, as you said, the president of the Senate, who said, no, we're going to go ahead because the process is now in train and we'll just go ahead.
Think he got a call from Washington or what?
No, I think that's, well, obviously, we have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. I'm sure that there are phone calls whizzing to and fro like crazy. But one of the things that is, and I think one of the things that has got the legislators somewhat concerned, and that they're something that they're anxious about, is that this is an election year for the legislature, and so and the rules have changed. The last year, legislation was passed making it illegal for people and individuals involved in the legislative elections to receive corporate funding.
Right.
And that, who knows how that's going to affect things? In theory, one would hope that the effect will be what the legislation was hoping to achieve, and that is to make the vote a more faithful reflection of the popular will, and rather than one based on how much money people standing for election are able to mobilize in support of their campaigns. So, but who knows how that's going to pan out? But, and I think that's something that we need to bear in mind when we're looking at everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Because obviously there are all kinds of influences in play.
Well, you have an added layer of that. Let's say that the law says, okay, you can't do this, so that means people can't get money that way. But you have these like relentless revelations almost daily of this one, that one, and another one inside the Brazilian legislature, having these secret accounts in various places, including in the Panama. I mean, as they keep rolling out players out of the Panama Papers, it's almost like a roll call of the opposition in the Brazilian parliament.
Even without those revelations, the makeup of the Senate, in the Senate, even without the Panama so-called Panama Paper revelations, half the people in the Senate have been accused in some shape or form of corruption,
right?
In a formal sense. I mean, not all of them are subject to any kind of legal process, but right. And that's so what that means, that this issue of corruption that you and I have discussed in the past, in particular in relation to Guatemala, and the way it's used to manipulate and mold political processes in favor of, you know, the people who control who ends up getting arraigned before a court for corruption. Those people control the political process,
right?
And together with that judicial control is the media control of what gets projected on the front pages or in in the news headlines. And so that the media judicial thing, that those two very interlinked aspects are absolutely crucial to how the whole process develops. Now, what Dilma Rousseff is now saying is that the impeachment process is illegal and an illegitimate usurpation of the democratic vote that she which she became president back in 2014. What does that mean? Does that mean she's going to play hardball and not string along with the procedural the actual procedure of the impeachment process, or are they going to somehow try and move forward some process in the Brazilian Supreme Court? And because the Brazilian Supreme Court seems to be playing a kind of 60-40 in favor of the opposition, and they've on the face of it, looking at the superficial events, the obvious events, what we can actually see, Dilma Rousseff is absolutely right. There's no basis for any kind of legal procedure against her.
Because right, she's not accused of... You're supposed to be accused of a crime, I guess, the Brazilian equivalent of high crimes and misdemeanors here in the U.S. under the U.S. Constitution. And what she's accused of, essentially, is a bookkeeping, either manipulation or error, and not... for any personal gain, but
policies. It isn't even a crime.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. There's no legal basis for the impeachment. There's been no violation of the law.
Yeah, and she and her has pointed out in her public statements that she has made far fewer of the adjustments that were necessary to make in order to keep their anti-poverty programs solvent during the period in question.
Right, which was
than
a period
her predecessors.
Right. That's right, exactly.
You know, who didn't have any kind of anti-poverty program worth the name,
except for themselves.
So, you know, I remember you said this in one of our earliest conversations about this crisis in Brazil, that in effect, what Dilma Rousseff is being penalized for is taking the necessary steps to guarantee the anti-poverty program.
That's right. I mean, look, she pointed out, she gave an interview last Friday to Telesur, a good 30 minutes plus, in detail. She started out reciting the history of the attempts by the right, you know, to remove her from office that began immediately after her reelection. They right. challenged the vote itself. That was shown to be empty. There were one after another attempts to, you know, remove her and essentially to negate the election.
Yeah, and left-wing critics of Dilma Rousseff say, well, that's what you get for making a deal with the right.
Well, yeah, okay.
You know, the alternative was either to achieve power with making a deal with center-right political opportunities. Right. Or not to achieve power,
right? I assume what they're hoping is that she's going to stand up, put a call for the revolution. Some of the people will stand up. Maybe a little more than half the people will stand up. The army will crush it. It'll kill the leadership and a good many other people. But that was a morally justified revolution, and we'll try again in another 20 years. I mean, that's all they're offering, as an alternative.
Yeah, and so the only reason I mentioned that is because it just shows how deeply complicated the situation is from the point of view of Dilma Rousseff and the Workers' Party.
Which reflects what's, the situation in other countries as well, in Venezuela and Argentina, as we've discussed.
Yeah, and the essential thing is one of the leading Sandinista analysts and strategists here, a guy called Orlando Nunez Soto, remarked in an article that he wrote in Spanish, that one of the key things is that when people win by a small margin, a statistically kind of irrelevant margin of, say, anything between 1% and 2%, and they're duty bound really to kind of take into account the feelings of the large number of people that voted against them.
Of course.
Now, what you can see, the crisis in Argentina is a direct result of Macri refusing to do that.
Right. That's correct.
If you accept, let's accept for a moment that the electoral democratic system that prevails in most of Latin America and does offer some kind of more or less fair result, then, if you win with a tiny majority, like Dilma did, she only won by something like 2% against Aécio Neves back in 2014, and she was able to form a government and operate on the basis that, or attempt to operate, against all the right-wing sabotage, on the basis that she had to govern in that context.
And, that's right.
But what Macri has done,
the opposite,
is the exact opposite, and he is now facing this wave of protests and strikes, and he himself is engaged in an unexpectedly bitter confrontation, from my point of view, with the Argentinian legislature that previously rolled over and voted in favor of this outrageous deal with the vulture funds, indebting Argentina in the first place to $16 billion, but it's going to work out a lot more than that over time.
Right.
And now they finally seem to have found some backbone. And they're standing up to Macri's policy of mass layoffs of workers in the public sector and encouraging so-called efficiency in the private sector, which is just code for unemployment.
Right. Neoliberal economics, so, efficiency.
Yeah. So let's see how all that stuff pans out in Brazil over the next few days. Tomorrow, either tomorrow or Thursday will be the vote. I don't know if the procedure has been delayed as a result of the shenanigans of the new interim president of the lower house in the Brazilian legislature. And if they have delayed, the vote may well be on the impeachment in the plenary session in the Senate may be delayed. But and if it's not delayed, it will be tomorrow. So, right.
And then the outcome of that is if it moves forward, then she's suspended for up to 180 days, and the vice president becomes the president pro tem, basically, until that process is finished. And then either she's removed from office or she returns to power and serves out the rest of her term.
Yeah, and that ultimate decision is also a decision apparently based in the Senate.
Yes.
Because the Senate is going to consider for the 180 days all the evidence pro and con,
right,
and then they'll make the final decision to judgment about whether she should be impeached or not.
Right.
But I mean, there's, you know, 6 months is an eternity in politics.
For sure.
Let's see what happens.
And then you've had an awful lot of activity in on the streets, including an occupation of one of the farms of the vice president in Sao Paulo province.
Right. No, I hadn't seen that, Don. You're more up to date than I am.
Well, on that anyway. So, yeah, I did see that. There was a it was Monday, as a matter of fact, that it was in Sao Paulo province, that about a 1,500 hectare property called Esmeralda, that is not in Vice President Temer's nominal name, but apparently the locals know that he's the owner, and so they occupied it and said they're denouncing his plots and an attempted coup.
Right, yeah, and the popular response on the streets and in the countryside in Brazil is going to be absolutely decisive. I think, in shaping how the whole process pans out. So
that's what we're seeing in Argentina. You see the legislature getting some backbone because they realize that Macri is going after their own constituency and that the left is not going to get reelected if they sit on their hands while masses of their voters are made unemployed.
Yeah. So then, sticking with the theme of elections, and last week, in Nicaragua, the Supreme Electoral Council announced the electoral calendar for this year's presidential elections. And I thought it was very interesting comparing the way Nicaragua's electoral process is managed to the way the disastrous electoral process has been managed in Haiti. And I was reading an article yesterday, and I'm just looking at it now, by a guy called Jackson Rateau in Haiti Liberté. And he's reporting, it's a very complete report, on the formation of an electoral verification commission in Haiti, whose job apparently is to look at to investigate the electoral process, the previous electoral process. And that commission has been vehemently opposed, in fact boycotted, the installation was boycotted, Rateau reports, by the ambassadors of the United States and its allies. And it's also coming in for a lot of criticism from the party of former President Michel Martelly.
Yeah.
So I think the object of that electoral commission is to create a context in which any new elections, because as I understand it, Haiti's still without a formally elected president; they just have an interim president. And I think that's, what's the name of that guy? And I think it's Privert, is it?
Yeah.
The current interim president, Joselin Privert. He's the current interim president.
Yeah, Privert, yeah.
And I think the idea is of this electoral verification commission is to create a context in which electors in Haiti or voters in Haiti have more confidence in the electoral process.
Mm. That's a tough,
sorry.
Given the recent history, that's a tough row to hoe, by the way, getting any confidence in what goes on there. It's been terrible.
Well, I was surprised that they managed to install that Electoral Verification Commission, given the vehement opposition by the United States and its international and local allies. Yeah. And who knows? It's hard to believe that they're just going to let that process go ahead and that let the Verification Commission report truthfully on what a disaster the previous elections were. But it's difficult to see any other road forward for Haiti if they're going to return to some kind of legitimate constitutional government.
It's a mess.
So then, what I thought was interesting about that, Don, was that when you compare that with the electoral processes in Nicaragua, and Nicaragua has had, and the last election, Daniel Ortega won with something like, I think it was 63-64% of the vote, something like that. And back then, even the Organization of American States accepted that the elections were free and fair and gave a more or less true result. But the European Union dragged its feet for a long time before admitting that the election was free and fair. And it's just such a contrast if you compare the absolutely desperately badly organized elections, completely corrupt and disrupted elections in Haiti, and the way those elections, the United States and its European allies, kind of welcomed those results.
Yeah, they lied right up. Right away. Oh, this is good. See, democracy works. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's been some kind of election, so therefore they accept that. Whereas if you compare what happened in 2011, where Daniel Ortega won by an absolute landslide. And they were very begrudging and kind of through clenched teeth, as it were, admitted that the elections gave a true and fair result. And that, but now, with regard to that, and what happened on Friday was that there was a public ceremony organized by the Supreme Electoral Council in Managua, and they declared the electoral calendar, explained what the process was going to be like, and they had an absolute array of international visitors, electoral specialists from all over Latin America and the Caribbean, you know, of absolutely impeccable integrity and impartiality. And it's very clear that they're going to use this electoral process to reinforce and highlight the electoral legitimacy of whoever is eventually elected. And it's almost certain to be Daniel Ortega. Because mm-hmm. yeah. I know that Daniel Ortega is standing again for re-election. And he's likely to get an even bigger landslide than he got back in 2011.
We can only hope that the West, I would say the United States and the EU, will respect that election much more than they respected the last election of Mel Zelaya in Honduras.
Right. Well, and I think it's interesting that at that ceremony on Friday, it was Latin American and Caribbean electoral representatives from the electoral powers of countries across the region who were present. I think then it's possible that there may have been some diplomatic representation, but in terms of representation of electoral observation bodies, for example, from I take for example the Carter Center or from Europe, they were not invited, or they just weren't there. And that seems to me to be, you know, whereas in Haiti the popular feeling and regional views and opinions that the protests in Haiti was corrupt and illegitimate, those were ignored by the United States and its allies. But in Nicaragua's case, what they're saying is it is our regional representatives who are going to decide the legitimacy or not of our election, not the United States, not the European Union.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.